You're listening to Red Nation Online.
Good day and welcome to From the Black Hole, episode 35. Today's podcast is Supermassive Edition Part 2, and in it we ask our collaborators questions that take them back in time in Canadian soccer. Okay, question number two. If you could go back in time, which of the so-called Canadian traitors would you convince to play for Canada and why?
Well, first off, this assumes I could actually convince a Canadian traitor.
Yeah, assume all that's gonna happen.
Which I don't think I would have that power of coercion.
Assume you would.
But assuming I did, I think the obvious answer is Hargraves. And the reason it's Hargraves is not just because of Hargraves and because of the time Hargraves could have played. Because Hargraves was voted England's best player at the 06 World Cup. And that qualifying team for 2010 that played in 2008 was the best Canadian team I've ever seen. I mean, they didn't do as well as they did in 2012, but that team with Julian de Guzman as the player of the year at Deportivo.
Right.
And that, like,
that was his apex.
That cannot be understated how good he was at that point. He was, like, he was scoring with Real Madrid. He was doing, like, all of these ridiculous things. Hutch was at his best. The one that people always forget is Kukowski. Mike Kukowski was the best left back in CONCACAF in 2008. And if we had added Hargraves to that team, I mean, we could have moved Hutchinson around, we could have done, that team could have, whatever we did with Hargraves, we could have made this team so much better. And, I mean, the second point of this is that we'd need a better coach than Mitchell was in 2008. But had we had Hargraves, it would have made a difference. So, yeah.
If you could go back in time, which of the so-called Canadian traitors would you convince to play for Canada, and why?
I'm going to stick with my original answer. I've had 2 days to think about this.
Good.
And I'm sticking with Jonathan de Guzman.
She's time-traveled anyway, because this is the
exactly.
First time she's ever done it.
I know, this has never happened before, but my past self has visited me. You know what? When de Guzman was waffling and going back and forth, it was at a time when we actually needed him, and we were on the cusp of good things happening for the Canadian men's national team. Maybe not, you know, upper echelons of the sport because we're not there yet, but his presence, both in terms of stature but in talent, would have made, I think, a ton of difference. And if what he said to his brother allegedly was that he would love to play for Canada, if that was actually true, if Julian had like one more conversation, if someone else had sat down with him and said, yeah, this is the way to go, it's what you want to do, the Netherlands, come back home, play for Canada, it would have made all the difference. So I'm sticking with Jonathan de Guzman.
It would probably still be the de Guzman brother, I think. Jonathan. We just saw him in the World Cup, and, you know, you don't make that Holland squad unless you have quality. And even though he plays in the EPL, I think he's a guy who could be around for a long time. We saw, let's say, Owen Hargreaves, the style he played, his career was kind of cut short by it. And, you know, obviously Begovic is a good keeper and whatnot, but I don't think that's as much of a troublesome position. I think a lot of times we've lacked that player in the midfield who can sort of really dominate things and deliver a killer ball. We've had some players, but yeah, I think out of all of them, it would be Jonathan de Guzman.
Okay.
Plus, he looked good in his Canada stuff when he was attending the games. So,
I think I remember going blind at some point, listening to that interview with rage, and just was like, and so I don't even remember if he was wearing a Canada kit or not. Yes, I do, actually. He's wearing the Centennial kit, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, that was such a bang your head against the wall moment.
If you could go back in time, which of the so-called Canadian traitors would you convince to play for Canada, and why? Come on. That's probably going to be the best answer we get from anybody the entire night.
Owen Hargreaves. Because to me, he was the first. If you can set the precedent that this is a country worth playing for, this is a country worth putting your shirt, this is a country that helped you become the player that you are, and that in some weird way you feel indebted to represent them at a national level, let him be the poster child of, like, no, I could play for all these other countries. I'm going to play for Canada, the country that got me kicking a ball.
Junior Hoilett.
You consider him a traitor?
Yeah. Junior Hoilett and Jonathan DeGuzman. I take that back. Jonathan DeGuzman more so. Because his brother actually played for Canada. His brother came back to Toronto and, you know, he got dicked around by TFC, but what Canadian international didn't. But Jonathan DeGuzman, and good on him for making the national squad for the Netherlands, but he wasn't born there. He's lived there for a long time, and I understand that at his age, it's been tough it's not too impossible to make it to the top levels of football if you're in Canada. But I just think that if you have that family connection to the national program, and you've got such a high profile, you have a responsibility to come back to Canada and grow that profile and grow that culture here. And I think that the way that he just turned his back on us is traitorous. And I love the way the kid plays. I think he's an amazing talent. And I can't really fault him for wanting to play at that top level and making a World Cup-bound team. But at the same time, I'm still a little bitter because it's guys like him who need to come back and sort of sacrifice in order to help us grow the importance of soccer here in Canada.
This is kind of an emotional one.
I know, I just dislike so many of them now. I just can't even think to a time when I didn't. I guess keeping with the women's national team theme, that striker that plays for the U.S.
The one who shall remain nameless?
Yeah, will still remain nameless. It's just another one that slipped through our hands, you know? She played for us at an under-17. For a while, I don't know why, but for a while I thought that she was only in the under-15 pool. Until a couple months ago, I was like looking through old U17 like FIFA reports, and I'd seen she was like a substitute twice for us, and I kind of blew my mind because I didn't know.
Senior? No, or under 17.
Yeah. It sounds silly because I'd already disliked her so much.
Right.
Just feel more fire.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's one that slipped through our hands. One that, obviously, with our phenomenal scoring, obviously.
Does Junior Hoilett count because he hasn't committed yet?
Yes, we will count him.
I'd say him. I want him to play. He's from Brampton. I'm from Brampton, so there's that connection.
Oh, the connections.
But outside of that, this national team really needs a forward they can build off of, and that's the guy to me. I mean, he's on QPR right now, but I think if he moves to a bigger club or they stay in EPL or something and he gets consistent games, you could build your program off of a guy like that. Because we tried that with Simeon Jackson when he was...
Simeon, yeah.
When he's there.
Whenever you say Simeon Jackson's name, you always have to say it in a TNT accent, you know. It's not Simeon, it's Simeon.
Simeon Jackson.
That is brilliant. Oh my god, that is the best one ever. All right. Anyway, let's keep going.
But basically...
Holy crap, that is so perfect.
Okay,
so I'm gonna grab that as a sound clip, and every podcast we're gonna drop it in randomly.
Anyway.
God, that's perfect.
So that's the guy I would choose, Junior Hoilett.
Junior Hoilett, all right.
Well, one of their names I can't even say by virtue of my own self-imposed long-running shtick. But honestly, I think that it has to be Owen Hargreaves. It has to be. Not only because of the talent that he would bring to the team, but he is the player that a lot of people look, you know, he's the kind of player around which this schism is created. The schism between the people who say, you know, he was born in Canada, grew up in Canada, and then all of a sudden he felt something else. Versus, and are upset by that. Canadian supporters who would have wanted him to play for us. Versus people who say, yeah, but look at it pragmatically. He played for England. He got to play in a World Cup. He got to play in the Champions League. You know, he got to make these inspiring comeback videos running on treadmills 10 years afterwards. But he is the one that opened that door and created the perception for everyone in this country, for the media, for fans, for young players, that, oh, yeah, you might be born in Canada, but wow, look what you can do if you go and represent a country that's not Canada. And if Hargreaves had not decided to represent England, if he had stayed in Canada, you know, who knows how different things would be right now. Maybe Jonathan de Guzman would have been playing alongside his brother. Maybe David Hoilett would have suited up for Canada by now. Maybe the Bosnian goalkeeper would still be playing for Canada, although maybe not. And even so, you know, I mean, look, if I could go back in time, well, there might be other things I would do beyond convincing Owen Hargreaves to play for Canada.
No, you can only go back for that sole purpose. I mean, that's a part of the question. It's very restrictive,
unfortunately. Well, yeah, sure, but every single sci-fi television show or movie I've ever seen, there are very specific rules about what you can and can't do when you go back into, oh, you can't interact with yourself, you can't change the past. And they say, oh, yeah, sure, and then they go and do it, and, oh, well, things just happen. I mean, look, if we're going to set down Doctor Who-esque rules, those are just made to be broken. So I'm going to go back and become Owen Hargreaves and then pretend I'm playing for England, and then come out at Wembley and NWO style rip off my England jersey to reveal a Canada kit, spray paint, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about now. But yeah, he's the one who got the ball rolling, and, you know, but we can't think about what could have been had he or any of these other players I mentioned decided to play for Canada. What we need to do is focus on the players that have decided that Canada is their best option, because those are the players that we're going to live and die by as fans, and those are the ones that deserve our attention, deserve our written words, our spoken words, and our devotion as Canadian soccer supporters.
I think, personally, I will say Owen Hargreaves, and I say Owen Hargreaves because time and place. Because now I don't know, you see, this is the problem with someone in analytics, is I don't know if the Canadian coaching staff and what they did would have been smart enough, but if Owen Hargreaves played for Canada, and Canada was able to establish a three-man midfield of the Guzman, Di Rosario, and Hargreaves, I think that would have given them enough to get into the World Cup and to be successful.
See, this is a little bit part where I'm going to struggle, the back in time. I've seen some older stuff, but I don't know a ton about it.
Well, who's a big name that you would bring back to the Canadian fold and make them not go where they went?
If you could have made Owen Hargreaves a Canadian somehow.
Bingo.
You have to do that. I mean,
he started the train. He started the train out of town.
Exactly. He started the train out of town. I mean, if you're going to play for England, I mean, Christ, you're going to be amazing with Canada.
If you could go back in time and take over the CSA with ultimate authoritarian power, what date would you pick and what would you do with that ultimate authoritarian power?
Date. I would probably go with 2000. Like, try and build something off of that Gold Cup win, because that was the last really major moment, I think, in Canadian men's soccer anyway.
Yeah.
And I think you could have really built something off of what we had there. And I would just, you know, kind of take the youth development structure we're trying to build now and bring it back to that point, so that you could just build up the program, and then you wouldn't have had 8-1, and you wouldn't have had all the negative things to happen.
Negative, negative things? What are you talking about?
All the stuff that just snowballed. I don't know. So basically, that's the date that I would pinpoint as that was the high, and you could have built off of that. That's basically what I think.
I'm going to put this question on its head, and I'm going to put this question on its head, and I'm going to take over the CSA in 3 or 4 years' time.
Ah, he's traveling into the future. He's going back to the future. Oh my God, litigation!
Because arguably, now unless you wanted me to go back to 84 with the CSL or NASL when Canadian, you know, arguably, you know, just as a side note, I think the all the stories about the NASL and its failure are complete bullshit. I think if you look at sports in the early 80s and late 70s, NBA was close to bankruptcy, and NHL was a mom-and-pop station with Edmonton being the top league team in the world. Baseball and NFL were good, but not to where they were now. So if the NASL could have stayed where they were in the 80s and existed today, I think they would have gotten the same push from media and television and fans as those other sports had. And I think they would have been viable sports leagues and now, today.
Huh.
Right? So just to add that to a point, right? So if I went back to 84, I would have pulled them as they are and stick to the thing. Like, maybe not go as crazy as Cosmos did, but I'd stick to the direction that they were going into and try to exist during the lean periods, because you'll get greatly rewarded as long as you survive. And one of the reasons, good segue, one of the reasons I'm going into the future is for the same reasons. Because, as I said, I think in a few years' time, Canada will be at its golden age of soccer with a lot of money coming in, with a lot of opportunities coming in, and it's how you hold it down at that point. You know, we got to stop people taking money, we got to stop people from spending stupidly, and we got to look at it seriously. And so I think that's the most important time that the CSA will deal with.
What date would I pick?
Yes.
The day that Canada was eliminated from the 1986 World Cup. Because I think it's been all downhill from there.
Kate, what would you do with the power? Like, what would you do once you assumed ultimate control?
I wouldn't treat the CSA as sort of like the mob. That's the main thing. It just seems like an old boys club. It seems like it's the mob. It seems like they're just using it to line their own pockets. To the detriment of the sport, of growing the sport in Canada. And just because you've got European last names doesn't mean that you know better. And I think they've actually, the CSA continues to set Canadian football back every year by about 5 more years. So I would go back and I would scrap everything about the CSA and start fresh. I create academies throughout the country, and not for clubs, but for the national system. I would put national headquarters, or headquarters for the national program, in every major city, and even some of the larger suburbs as they started to pop up, in order to scout these players and find them opportunities abroad. So the CSA is now paying for players to go abroad and develop their skills, and paying for them to come back, so that these players feel like they actually owe the CSA, or they have some sort of relationship that some sort of reciprocal relationship with the CSA, as opposed to feeling like they were ignored or even worse yet, screwed by the CSA.
Go back in time to do that. Man, that's a slow road I'm on right now. Like, I don't need to... I just need to see how this plays out.
I missed the second half of that question. I assume it was, what would I do differently?
What would you do differently at that particular date? They kind of go together in a way. Right?
Yeah, yeah. How far back are we going in this?
Go anywhere you want.
Anywhere I want. I think that, you know, the ongoing Achilles heel in many respects, and I mean, I understand why it's the case, but the ongoing Achilles heel of the CSA is the extent to which the tail wags the dog, the outsized influence that the provinces have. And I understand that funding traditionally has not come from anywhere. The CSA has not been well supported by the federal government. It has not been well supported by corporate sponsorships. That's changing. They have picked up a lot more sponsorships. I know that the Olympic athletes, the women's national team, they've been getting on the podium funding, which is good, of course. But even in their most recent annual report, where they've got more sponsorship money, they've got a bunch of money coming in by virtue of hosting the U20 and Senior Women's World Cup. The largest single source of revenue for the CSA continues to be player fees. And that's why the provinces have had this outsized influence on what happens. And it's why it's been impossible to this point for our national governing body to say, look, this is our plan. This is how we are going to improve player development. This is how we're going to improve the lot of our men's national team, our women's national team, our player development, our referee development, our coaching development. This is our vision. This is what we're going to do. They have not been able to do that traditionally, and they still are finding tremendous roadblocks to doing that. And this is not to... this is not to make this a black and white proposition. This is not to say that everyone who's ever been on a board of directors for a provincial association were holding things back, didn't know what they were doing. That's not what I'm saying. And I'm also not saying that everybody who has had a significant role in the CSA traditionally would have necessarily led us in the right direction had they been given the reins. But what I am saying is that the situation as it has been dysfunctional. And in order for progress to be made, the situation needs to be the same as it is in any other soccer country in the world. The national governing body has to have the clout to say, this is our plan, and this is how we're going to enact it. This is not to say they're infallible. I'm an outspoken proponent of the long-term player development plan that's being put into place right now, but that's not to say that I believe it's perfect, or that it's being implemented perfectly, or that it's being communicated perfectly. But we need to be in a situation where the national governing body, whose priority is our national teams, not provincial interests, not local interests, not, you know, about making sure that the best players stay at our provincial team so that we can win the Jubilee Cup or whatever the case may be.
The Clavette Cup. That would be the Dog River reference. That was the...
It's always Saskatchewan.
Of course it is. Well, we're from there, right? That's the cup that they played in the local curling bond spiel in Dog River. The Clavette Cup. The Clavette is actually a town in Saskatchewan. Anyway, sorry. I digress.
We need to focus less on the Canadian soccer equivalent of the Clavette Cup.
That's right, the Clavette
and
Cup.
And focus more on the World Cup. The Men's World Cup, the Women's World Cup. And it's going in the right direction. So to answer your question, if I had this time machine... I would try to ensure that some of the changes that are being enacted now would have been enacted sooner. Because if they had been, we may not be sitting in the situation we're sitting in right now, where the men's team is ranked 118th in the world. And the women's team, yes, they won bronze at the Olympics. Everyone knows that. Everyone remembers that. It was a great moment. But
what are they going to do next year?
But is that sustainable? We're going to see. And, I have a lot of respect for everything the women's national team has been able to do. But we'll see, we'll see how things go in the next 5-10 years. We'll see things when the current generation of star players, when their day is done. We'll see how this team does without Christine Sinclair and Erin McLeod and Diana Matheson and those sorts of players. So the point is, a strong national governing body
that can implement its plans to the benefit of the national program is something that might have helped us in where we're sitting now.
I don't remember the exact year now, but I would go back and I would have kept Holger Osiek, and I would have surrounded him by more coaches from Germany, and I would have got them working with the youth teams and at the youth level. And you know, obviously that was a few years, that was even a few years before the German Revolution that led to this current World Cup winning team. But I still think losing him at that point set the program back quite a few years. And I still think he was probably one of the most knowledgeable coaches we'd ever had. And if he'd had the proper support and infrastructure, I think it could have been a different story.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like that one.
Well, first of all, if I was running the CSA, I'd probably off myself because, Christ, that sounds like a thankless job. But
fair enough.
Late. It'd be nice to jump in when they were doing well and kind of keep things going. Late 80s, early 90s. I mean, we made 86. We almost made 94. It would have been nice to jump in there and kind of keep the ball rolling. Like I says, I don't know a ton about the past, so I just kind of have to, like, guess and go with it.
Yeah.
Let's go post-86 and keep this good train rolling, you know? Keep this shit rolling.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
I'm going to go back to 1982, lead up to all the stuff that happened in 86. And because Canada was in a semi-good place that year, 86. But I think there needed to be more of a background leading into that, because 86, they overachieved and then completely crumbled into dust. If there had been better academies in place, if there had been better funding in place, and there had been a better national program in place where kids were playing soccer at all levels across the country, where there was national advertising, where there was actual media attention to it, like the CSA still at that point in time, well, and now, they're all fractured. Provinces don't talk to one another. Everyone's got a different development program. Everyone's got a different academy program. There has to be a national structure in which every province does the same bloody thing. Otherwise, we're never going to develop as a country. What they need to do is they need to go visit Germany and see what they do, because they have the best freaking academy system in the world. They need to go to Australia. Australia tore their system apart. They tore it down to the bare bones and they rebuilt it. And then suddenly they're overachieving and they are making inroads all over different levels of international soccer. So that is what I would have done.
So there was a great segment that did on... Sorry to promote one of your competitors.
That's okay.
There was a great segment.
We don't have competitors. We're all mutually supporting.
There was a great segment they did on Two Solitudes last week where they're looking at... So the 2000 Gold Cup team got inducted into the Canadian Soccer Hall of Fame this last week. And Dwayne was saying that one thing that 2000 did, which was, I think, really similar to 2012 with the women's team, is that 2000 convinced us we were doing okay. And we weren't. And in 2000, we won the Gold Cup, and Canadian soccer said, you know what, we're the best team, we're one of the best teams at CONCACAF, if not the best. We're doing okay. Meanwhile, the grassroots, everything was falling apart. And Holger Osiek was a good coach, but that he wasn't a Canadian coach, first off, and it didn't mean anything in terms of, like, continuity, in terms of going forward. So I'd go back to 2000, and, I mean, what I would do, I'd say, is more focus on the grassroots, more focus on making sure that these, trying to break down these provincial barriers, the sort of regionalism that still exists today. But if we focus on that in 2000, when our team, our national team was good, and we had things going on in the youth teams, which you can see based on, like, what happened in the 03 under-20s, and that 03 under-20 team with Hume and Hutchinson became the 2008 qualifying team. So, like, if I go back to that time, I feel like things down the road might be a little better.
Dave? If you could go back in time and take over the CSA, what date would you go back to? And what would you do with that power?
Oh gosh, that's a tough one. I'm going to have to go date. I'm going to have to say somewhere around 1991. And I would get knee deep in the Canadian Soccer League. I would do whatever it takes to help prop that league up. If that includes propping up a couple clubs, even just geographically convenient. I know it wasn't the most perfect league in the world, but it was our league, and most importantly, it was my league. That was my introduction to footballdom. It wasn't through family or parents or neighbors. I went to Hamilton Steelers games as a kid. I love them. I adore them to this day. They're a legend in my head, and I would have kept that alive. I would have desperately tried to keep that alive no matter what. Even if it could last another two more years, I would have put all eggs into that basket to save it.
That's interesting, too, because it's funny. I interviewed Bobby McMahon a few months ago, and it made like two episodes of our podcast. And he was talking about how that CSL generation of players was this close to, and of course it's something I knew, but it never really had to put that way. Mm-hmm. We're so close to making the World Cup that if they had made it, maybe the CSL would still be alive.
The A-League in Australia kind of had that same thing. The first year they jumped to the Asian Confederation, they genuinely felt that if they hadn't made the World Cup qualifying through Asia, that would have destroyed the league and everything they built.
Right.
But they made it, so we'll never find out what would have happened had they not. That being said, that league produced so much talent. Like, not so much guys who were good in the CSL, but guys who went on to careers outside of the CSL. Right. Like, to think that Alex Bunbury would have been a star in Portugal blows my mind.
Right.
I'm desperately trying to think of a guy out in Vancouver, went over to England and played there forever. Anyway, there's at least a dozen guys who went overseas to have full careers being paid like pros.
Right.
And if they'd left, there would have been somebody to replace them who were playing pro football from the age of 16, 17, whatever, onward. That's massive in development.
That's kind of what we need right now.
Yeah, there's that gap from when you graduate high school to, or in some cases, university. It's like, all right, well, good luck to you.
Yeah.
Those are the formative years.
This is a good question, actually. If I were to pick one big date, I'd probably go back to the summer of 2002.
Ah!
Because in the summer of 2002, we just had the Women's U19 World Championship. And as we know, the Women's U19 World Championship was a great success. It led to us getting the U20 World Cup in 07, which led to us getting BMO Field, which led to Toronto FC, which led to Montreal and Vancouver coming to Canada.
Yes.
So it's very much the nexus of modern Canadian soccer.
And ooh, this is so scientifically extreme. There's so much that the web of time in this is superseding this podcast.
I'm picking the fulcrum here. And what I would do is I would take that National Soccer Stadium and I would take MLSE coming up to me saying we want to put a team in it. I'd be like, great, you will be the flagship team in our new Canadian Soccer League. You and your women's program will be the two flagships. You know, we've got BC Place. It's not renovated yet since 2005 or so. But, you know, the Whitecaps have a W League team that's making $1 million. They've got a USL1 team, as it was then, that's doing very well. And they're trying to get a waterfront stadium through. All of a sudden, I've just run one successful World Cup. I'm about to run another successful World Cup. Do you think that waterfront stadium's not getting built? Yes, it is. As we speak, Montreal Impact are renovating this old training ground by the Olympic Stadium that's going to become Stade Saputo. Hey, Montreal Impact, you're coming into our Canadian Soccer League with the women's program. It's just everything is happening. Now I've got three teams, new stadiums on all three. They're all on board because they're getting something out of it. At that point, it's easy to go to Edmonton, Calgary, Saskatoon, definitely not Regina.
No, never.
Quebec City and say, this is all happening. Are you in or out? This is happening. I have signatures from the three biggest media markets. Are you doing it or are you not doing it? They're doing it. There have been people in these cities who have just been saying, oh, I don't want to take the jump. Well, the jump's been taken. Now they just have to sign on the dotted line. Two pro leagues, men, women. We're not relying on the Americans. We're developing our own talent. And in 2025,
all of a sudden, we've got full-time technical coaches who were coached by full-time technical coaches, and we've got women who are coming from the ground up in this system, and they are the best in the world. And that's how it's going to happen. So that's my answer. 2002.
And that's all for Supermassive Part 2. Part 3 will be coming soon, as will other podcasts, so stay tuned. Until then, take care.